will be to require Monsanto to clearly label Roundup as containing a compound that is a threat to human life.
California will be the first state to name glyphosate as a cancer risk, though France has already banned the product for sales in garden centers. And according to the environmental group Friends of the Earth, the pesticide can get into water sources and poses a threat to aquatic life.
The El Niño phenomenon may bring more rain to parts of California, but there is another effect from the rising temperatures in the eastern Pacific Ocean. More great white sharks and hammerheads.
The warmer waters are bringing tropical fish closer to the coast of Southern California, followed by the sharks that eat them.
The Huntington Beach Independent reports that earlier this month, a group trying to catch yellowtail off Sunset Beach encountered a 10-foot hammerhead, and the day before, a kayaker was bitten on the leg by a hammerhead near Malibu.
Chris Lowe from Long Beach State University said that it's a different ocean out there than it was 40 or 50 years ago, and big predators are coming back, including seals and sea lions, in addition to the sharks. And finally this week, we've all heard the expression, out of one's gourd, but how about in one?
Last week, a man in Massachusetts paddled an 817-pound pumpkin down a river, not as a crazy stunt or to squash any records, but to get kids interested in agriculture.
Piloting his hollowed-out gourd wasn't easy. Todd Sandstrom only made it about halfway down the river because of low water levels, logs, and rocks.
He's calling his journey a success anyway because of the amount of media attention he garnered. He told the local paper, The Enterprise, that he thinks he was able to get across the true message of farming and to get people to buy local food and support local agriculture, adding that if his trek made just one kid get in the dirt, it was all worth it.
And an unexpected bonus? Sandstrom might get into the Guinness Book of World Records for the longest journey in a pumpkin. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Three U.S. cities are on a list of 96 cities worldwide that have committed to 100% renewable energy production in the near future. The U.S. cities on the list are Aspen, Colorado, Burlington, Vermont, and Greensburg, Kansas. A British nonprofit organization, the Carbon Disclosure Project, has issued a report showing that over 50 cities are already producing 3/4 of their electricity from non-fossil fuel sources. According to the report, power generation is the single largest carbon emitter in the global energy market, with cities consuming 3/4 of the energy produced. The director of data innovation at the Carbon Disclosure Project said that one of the biggest challenges for cities is often the lack of direct control over their electricity generation. Despite this, cities are well placed to lead the transition away from fossil fuels and are finding ways to shake up their energy mix. It was easy for Greensburg, Kansas, to make the change after a powerful tornado totally destroyed the town almost 10 years ago. Since then, the community has recreated itself with a focus on wind generation, solar power, and energy-efficient buildings. Greensburg was not motivated by environmental concerns, but wanted to be more self-sufficient and economically viable, and to adapt to the changing climate.
European Union leaders meeting in Brussels today agreed on a plan to settle 120,000 refugees in European Union nations. That's a drop in the bucket compared to the total number of refugees flowing into Europe from Syria and other nations. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees warned that this could be the last chance for a coherent European response to the crisis, which is increasing the suffering and exploitation of refugees and migrants, and escalating tensions between countries. The ministers approved the agreement over the objections of the Czech Republic, Hungary, Romania, and Slovakia. Hungary has come under mounting criticism from human rights groups and international organizations over its treatment of refugees. Hungarian police and official have been accused of instigating and ratcheting up the violence. UNHCR's Antonio Guterres took EU nations to task for their handling of the refugee crisis, pointing out that When in 1956 200,000 Hungarians fled to Austria and Yugoslavia, not only were people properly received, but a relocation program was quickly put into place and 140,000 people were relocated to other countries. What was possible then should be possible now.
Earlier this month, a 3-judge panel in the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that immigration courts must distinguish between sexual orientation and gender identity in immigrants seeking asylum or relief from deportation. The court said Carrie Avendaño Hernández, a transgender woman originally from Mexico, should be allowed to stay in the U.S. because she faced grave physical threats in her home country distinct from the risks experienced by gays and lesbians. Immigration and transgender activists are cheering the decision, as well as a new ICE policy of segregating trans detainees based on their gender identity. FSRN's Larry Poole has more from Los Angeles.
Carrie Avendaño Hernández unlawfully entered the U.S. in 2000 and settled in Fresno, California. She began hormone therapy 5 years later and has lived as a woman ever since. In 2006, she was arrested and convicted of felony drunk driving. After serving a year in jail, where she was housed with male inmates, she was deported to Mexico. She re-entered the U.S. in 2008 and was again arrested. This time she sought relief from deportation under the UN Convention Against Torture. She argued that her appearance and transgender identity put her at high risk of physical and sexual violence in Mexico. Avendaño Hernández says that in 2007, after her deportation, 4 uniformed police officers abducted her after she passed through a roadside checkpoint in Oaxaca, Mexico, and drove her to an unknown location.
And then they abused me, sexually abused me, they raped me, and they told me, you know what, you want to say something about what we did to you, we're going to kill your family, and they left me after they abused me and beat me.
She says that experience prompted her to go back to California. When attempting to cross the border, she says uniformed Mexican soldiers stopped her group and singled her out for a sexual assault. But those stories weren't enough to sway the Board of Immigration Appeals to let her stay in the U.S. The board considered her felony conviction to be a particularly serious crime, and it pointed to the recognition of same-sex marriage in Mexico City as evidence that LGBT Mexicans didn't face undue discrimination or hardship. Attorney Andrea Ruth Byrd argued Avendaño Hernández's case before the Ninth Circuit and told the judges that just because gays and lesbians have some protections in the Mexican capital, that doesn't mean transgender individuals are safe.
In the case of Ms. Avendaño Hernández, she's worried about being free from torture, and there's nothing in the law in Mexico that is helping prevent that. And to the extent even that there are laws in place saying, you know, you shouldn't torture anyone, those aren't being enforced. They were police officers that attacked her and military officers that attacked her. So being able to get married as a gay person in Mexico City isn't really anything that's going to help her out in her particular situation.
The 3-judge panel on the Ninth Circuit agreed, saying the Board of Immigration Appeals was wrong to conflate sexual orientation and gender identity. Writing for the panel, Judge Jacqueline Nguyen noted that Mexico has one of the highest documented number of transgender murders in the world. The panel ruled that even though Avendaño Hernández's felony conviction would make her ineligible for deferred deportation, there was enough evidence to grant relief under the Convention Against Torture. Manmeet Soni is a staff attorney at the Public Law Center in Santa Ana, California, and she also worked on Avendaño's case. She says immigration courts and other circuit courts will look to this decision for guidance on cases of transgender immigrants from Mexico and from other countries.
Everything in the immigration court process works very slowly, so I don't think, unfortunately, it's going to fast-track any of the cases. It for sure doesn't create some sort of blanket protection for all trans individuals seeking relief from the United States. They still have a burden to demonstrate eligibility for that relief. At least at the immigration court level, we hope that many more individuals will be able to rely on this decision in support of their case and will be successful at that first level so that they don't need to go through this process that we had to go through.
Hard numbers aren't available, but Immigration Equality, an organization that provides legal services to LGBT immigrants, estimates that about 200 immigrants seeking asylum in the U.S. at any given time are transgender. Corrections authorities still lack comprehensive protocols for these detainees, but a recent memo by ICE clarified things a bit by ending the long-standing policy of housing transgender women with men. The ICE Transgender Care Memo tells staff to place transgender immigrants in housing appropriate to the immigrant's gender identity, but it does nothing to stop the policy of physically isolating trans detainees, a practice known as protective custody, or de facto solitary confinement. Aaron Morris is the legal director for Immigration Equality. He says the problem is not so much how detention centers treat immigrants, but the fact that so many are locked up there for so long.
You know, if someone comes to the United States, especially if they have a defense to removal and they are putting forward a legitimate claim for relief or for deportation termination of some kind, then paroling that individual out is an option. If the government has concerns about that person's whereabouts or they think that they're a flight risk, you know, they can put them on regular check-ins with ICE. They can release them into a community program, community programs who commit to bringing the person to court, finding the person a place to live, providing that person with basic needs. And those programs have been very, very successful.
For now, Avendano Hernandez is working as a cook in Fresno and says that while she still faces some discrimination, at least she doesn't fear for her life. Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
You're listening to the Kate Boo Evening.
And now the latest in news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, September 22nd, 2015. Israeli troops killed two Palestinian civilians during separate attacks and invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Two Palestinians have been killed on Tuesday in two separate incidents by Israeli troops' gunfire in the southern West Bank district of Hebron. Diya Tal Ahmed, 21, from Dura town near Hebron city, was killed on Tuesday at dawn near the Khersa junction south of Dura. The army claims that the young man tried to throw a grenade into the combat engineers battalion and that the grenade detonated before he managed to throw it, leading to his death. An ambulance of the Palestinian Red Crescent rushed to the scene, but the soldiers sealed the entire area and prevented them from reaching him. After the news about the death of the young man spread, clashes took place near Khersa roadblock, and the soldiers responded by firing tear gas on protesters and several homes. Medical sources said that many residents suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation. Soldiers also invaded homes and searched them and occupied several rooftops to use them as firing posts. Later in the day, Hadil Hashlamon, 18, was critically injured and later died of her wounds on Tuesday afternoon when soldiers shot her at an Israeli military checkpoint in Ashuhada Street in Hebron Old City. Media sources in Hebron said that Hadil was injured in her abdomen and that the soldiers left her bleeding onto the ground for nearly 30 minutes and prevented Palestinian medics from approaching her. The Israeli army claims the young woman attempted to stab a soldier. The Israeli military initially said that the woman was shot in her legs and later said she was in critical condition. She was moved to Shaar Tzedek Medical Center in Jerusalem where she died of her wounds. According to her family, Hadil was a first-year student at the Hebron University. Elsewhere, three Palestinians were injured and one kidnapped on Tuesday at dawn when Israeli soldiers invaded the northern West Bank city of Nablus and clashed with local youth. Two of the injured were hit with rubber-coated metal bullets in the head and the arm. Meanwhile, the third suffered effects of tear gas inhalation, local medical sources reported. Local sources added that troops stormed homes and searched them in several areas of Nablus city before kidnapping one man and leaving the area.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Doug McVeigh and Cliff Berla and Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Rowland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio, featuring members of a new ballot measure to ban bottled water operations, including a proposed Nestle plant in Hood River County. At 9, we speak with Brad Evans about his book Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle, co-authored with Henry Giroux. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Recovery Zone, author Janet Cascadia discusses her visionary novel, The Tyranny of Psychopaths. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our membership drive last week. If you missed it, it's not too late. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Buffalo herd, you can't roller skate in the buffalo herd. You can't roller skate in the buffalo herd, but you can be happy if you've mind to.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, hosted Wednesday, September 23rd at 7 p.m. at Bison Coffee House in Portland. The event will feature stories and songs about the last wild buffalo and information about the ongoing struggle to protect them. That's the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, Wednesday, September 23rd, 7 p.m. at the Bison Coffee House, 3941 Northeast Cully Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day.